Okay, so we are now coming towards the very end of this retreat, and it's always amazing how quickly it goes. It kind of disappears into nothing, and it's kind of a reminder of how important it is to kind of get down to business and do the various things. But before I kind of summarize a bit about all the various things we have been talking about, I just want to finish off with the last couple of suttas. And they are quite profound. They're kind of interesting in their own way. But we'll have a look at them, and then we'll summarize a bit towards the very end. So just to bring this to a close, and again, these suttas are continuing on the same theme, the idea of the Buddha to be, and the sort of things that he did before his awakening, what kind of made him the Buddha, so to speak, the path that he practiced. Some of these things are more relevant for us, and some of them are a bit more kind of maybe theoretical, but nevertheless I thought they were kind of interesting here. So let's just have a look at this. The next sutta is from the Numerical Discourses, the chapter of 8, number 64, at Gaya Head. Gaya Sisa is the name of this sutta. So it's one of the suttas I wondered a bit afterwards, now, why did I include this sutta anyway? We'll see what happens. Sometimes life is a bit random. Huh? So this is how it goes. At one time the Buddha was staying near Gaya, at Gaya Head. And there the Buddha addressed the mendicants. Gaya Head is the same place, I think, where the sutta, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, the fire sermon, was addressed to the 1,000 fire ascetics soon after the Buddha's awakening. So this is like in the southern part of the Ganges region, close in Magadha, not so far from Rajagaha, in that area, close to the place of awakening itself. So he addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, before my awakening, when I was still not awake, but intent on awakening, I perceived light but did not see visions, or did not see forms as we saw before. Then it occurred to me, what if I were to both perceive light and see visions? Then my knowledge and vision would become even more purified. So after some time, living alone, withdrawn, heedful, keen, and diligent, I perceived light and saw visions, but I didn't associate with those deities, converse, and engage in discussion. So here we have a very similar opening to what we have in the Upakalesa Sutta, the Corruptions Sutta, where the Buddha-to-be, he sees lights and he sees, I think there the translation is vision of forms, here is just visions. And it's similar, but you can see here that the exact same phrasing is here used to see devatas, to say see deities, whereas in the other one it is used to see the mental reflex or whatever that actually takes you into samadhi. And this is what I said before, that sometimes these similar kind of things can have different meaning. And you need to be very, you need to kind of learn the distinction between the two. So seeing a deity can be similar to seeing a samadhi nimitta, light and forms. Which in a sense is what you would expect, right? Because if the mind is leaning towards the bliss of a samadhi nimitta, the light and forms, in a sense it is also leaning towards the devaloka at the same time, because that is what the devaloka is like. It is a place of light, a place of forms. It is a kind of much more fine, refined than the human realm. So it's kind of, you would expect these things to be related to each other. The deeper you go in meditation, the more higher is the kind of realm that it corresponds to, because every state of meditation kind of corresponds to a particular kind of rebirth. And the deeper you go, the higher is that realm that it corresponds to. So a stage of nimitta would correspond to a fairly high kind of devaloka. I don't know exactly where, tusita devas or something like that, the contented devas. Anyway, so you can see here the Buddha to be, he's not dissatisfied with his awakening. He wants to really understand the samsara, the various kinds of rebirth and everything. This is what is going on here. It's kind of investigating the whole of existence, really. So he perceives light, and then he also wants to see the visions of forms. And after some time, and of course, again, living alone, eka is the Pali word here, withdrawn, not, can't remember what the Pali word is, but anyway, either way, so he's in solitude and is also heedful, keen, and diligent. The same phrase we have been seeing all along here. So he sees them, and then the next thing, he wants to converse with them and engage in discussion with the deities. And having a conversation with them. And obviously the idea here is to find out about them, to see what kind of beings they are. So you have a chat with the deities, and hopefully you talk about meaningful things. You don't talk frivolous talk with the deities, and some papalapa, the kind of bad speech, but you talk about something meaningful and useful. I wonder whether the deities also indulge in gossip and things. Probably do. It's kind of this is what life is like. They probably also, have you heard about this deity? You know what they're up to? I don't know. But the Buddha, obviously, he wants to engage for a more purposeful reason. And then it occurred to me, what if I were to perceive light and see visions and associate with those deities, converge and engage in discussion? Then my knowledge and vision would become even more purified. So after some time, I perceived light and saw visions, and I associated with those deities, conversed and engaged in discussion. But I didn't know which order of gods those deities came from. Then it occurred to me, what if I were to perceive light and see visions and associate with those deities, converse and engage in discussion, and find out which order of gods those deities come from? Then my knowledge and vision would become even more purified. So now he's expanding his understanding of what the world is like. In other words, what possible rebirths there are. The idea here is to get an understanding of samsaric existence, to understand how it works. It's obviously the idea here. It's hard to know exactly when this is happening, whether this is happening before or after his awakening experience, at the root of the Bodhi tree. It's difficult to know. It may have happened afterwards, that he spent some time after his awakening. We don't know exactly what he did at that time, but he did spend quite a bit of time by himself. And so the question is, what did he do at that time? And maybe this is the sort of things that he did to get a full understanding of samsaric existence. So he wants to find out the order, in other words, the various kind of possibilities of being reborn of these deities. So after some time, I perceived light and visions, I associated with deities, and I found out which orders of gods those deities came from. But I didn't know what deeds caused those deities to be reborn there after passing away from here. So kamma and rebirth, So after some time, I found out what deeds caused those deities to be reborn there after passing away from here. But I didn't know what deeds caused those deities to have such food or such experience of pleasure and pain. So food here, the word is ahara, and ahara has this very general sense of nutriment in the suttas. And nutriment is anything that sustains you in a particular existence. And one of the things that sustain you is like the food you eat, the coarse food, ordinary food. But other things that sustain you are the things that make you interested in existence, that makes existence meaningful. It sustains your life in a certain realm. And one of those things is the will, the volition, because the will, you identify with that, and as long as you can exercise your will, and you have a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning, so it is a nutriment for existence. It's one of the four nutriments. Passa is another one. Passa is the word contact, and it really means just experience. The fact that you experience the world, this is one of the things that is a nutriment for existence, because we like to experience. We like to kind of, do all of these kind of things in the world, travel here and there, experience this and that. This kind of part of what it means to be human. And then the last one is consciousness itself, awareness of things. So these are like called four nutriments. And this is what this possibly refers to in part here, the idea, well, what is it that sustains in that particular realm? What is it that makes that realm interesting? Why do people want to hang out in these Devalokas? And of course, that is closely connected with the idea of pleasure and pain, because ultimately things are nutriments because they are considered positive, like a kind of pleasure, if you like. And so you want to understand the pleasure and pain in all of those realms. And then you start to understand how, why it is that beings hang out there, why they stay there for a certain amount of time, etc. After some time, I found out what deeds caused those deities to have such nutriment and such an experience of pleasure and pain. But I didn't know that these deities have a lifespan of such a length. How long do you stay in these realms? That's another important part of samsara, is the fact that these things are impermanent. How impermanent are they? How long? Maybe you stay there forever. And if you do stay there forever, then is it worthwhile? Or whatever. Well, after some time, I found out that these deities have a lifespan of such length. But I didn't know whether or not I had previously lived with those deities. This is one of the things the Buddha says elsewhere in the suttas, that we have all lived in all of these various realms. We have been there before. We have done all of these things before, and now we found ourselves back to square one. We're back to being humans again, even though we had this incalculable bliss in the past at some point. We're kind of back to square one. And that sort of is off-putting. There is no way of controlling these things. Sometimes we think that we can control our samsaric existence. I understand rebirth, I understand karma, I have all the information I need, now I can control where I get reborn, just because I understand the mechanism, how the driving force behind rebirth. But of course, that is a misunderstanding of how samsara works, because we control things only to the extent that we are conditioned in a certain way. And if you are conditioned to do the right thing, you will do the right thing. And the conditions change. There is no self that kind of always ensures that you live in the right way or appropriately. Then you get deluded. You head in the wrong direction again. You start doing stupid things. And you get reborn into all kind of places where you don't want to be reborn. This is the problem, back and forth. So we've been there before, but we have lost it. We have had the greatest bliss in the universe that you can possibly have, living there for eons, and now we're back here again. It's like this snakes and ladders. You kind of fall down that enormous ladder that takes you back, almost back to square one on this kind of board game. And sometimes it's even worse. Actually, human realm is not really square one. This is probably more like square five or something. But there are squares even earlier than that that are even worse. And so this is kind of the problem. Have I been there before? And of course, from the Buddha's point of view, you have been to all of these places before, except for one particular realm called the Suddhavasa. And the Suddhavasa is like called, Suddham is pure, and Avasa is like a place to abide, so often called the pure abodes. And these are realms that are only for non-returners. And so once you get reborn there, you are on the way out of samsara. Apart from that, you've been everywhere before. And it's kind of hard to imagine sometimes, isn't it? But this is what the Buddha is kind of saying here. Then it occurred to me, what if I were to perceive light and see visions and associate with those deities, converse and engage in discussion and find out which order of gods those deities come from and what deeds cause those deities to be reborn there after passing away from here. Here means the human realm. And what deeds cause those deities to have such nutriment or food and such an experience of pleasure and pain, and that those deities have a lifespan of such a length, and whether or not I have previously lived together with those deities, then my knowledge and vision would become even more purified. And after some time, I found out all of these things, including if whether or not I had previously lived together with those deities. As long as my knowledge and vision about the deities was not fully purified from these eight perspectives, I didn't announce my supreme perfect awakening in this world with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its gods and humans. But when my knowledge and vision about those deities was fully purified from these eight perspectives, I announced my supreme perfect awakening in this world with its god, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its gods and humans. Knowledge and vision arose in me. My freedom is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there will be no more future lives. So that is a curious little sutta. It's the kind of little things that you find in the corners of the Pali Canon, not often seen perhaps, but it shows you that the idea of awakening means more than just the awakening experience. It means having a more like a complete understanding of the nature of existence and what is possible. And so this is obviously an important part, to be able to be a teacher like the Buddha. Anyway, so that's just for your amusement, that little sutta. So I hope you are amused. And, and now we come to the very last sutta of this retreat. This is called The City. And the main reason why I like this sutta is the simile. It has a beautiful simile in there. But it is also about the idea of dependent origination, and it shows us that the Buddha's awakening experience, a very important part of it, was an insight into dependent origination itself. So maybe we can have a quick review of dependent origination, just to kind of bamboozle everyone at the very end of the retreat. And then when you get bamboozled, then you come back next year because you want to understand what this really is about, right? This is the trick of the trade. You learn certain tricks after a while, and you have to kind of you have to stop things at a certain point, kind of keep anyone on the knife's edge, and then they kind of, just like they do in these TV programs, right? They stop just before something is going to happen. And this is how these things are done, apparently. So I'm just kind of following an old tradition there. Anyway, at Savatthi. Mendicants, before my awakening, when I was still unawakened but intent on awakening, I thought... Yes, so we're still, during these suttas, we're talking about the practice of the Buddha to be him. And he thought, alas, this world has fallen into trouble. It is born, grows old, dies, passes away, and is reborn. Yet it doesn't understand how to escape from this suffering, from old age and death. And now we're almost back to where we started out on this retreat, where the Buddha was... reflecting before his awakening on the noble search and the ignoble search. And the noble search is where you find a solution to these things, right? And this is what the Buddha's search is about, finding a solution to the problems of existence. And so now we're going to look at this search to the problem from a different angle, from the angle of dependent origination, how you find a solution to these problems. And then he says, oh, when will an escape be found from this suffering, from old age and death? Then it occurred to me, when what exists is there old age and death? What is the condition for old age and death? And again, this shows you how the Buddha to be always reflects. It is always about causality. It's about understanding the causes for things. Because things only have solutions insofar as they have causes. When there is a cause, you can deal with the cause. If there is no cause, well, that means it is solid. It is a pillar. It stands firm in existence. It has an inherent essence to it that you cannot actually get away from. So either things have an inherent essence or they are causally originated. These are the two possibilities in the world. Or they can be random. That's the third reason. But random is kind of not really considered. It's either firm in existence or it's causally originated. And so from the Buddha's point of view, he's always looking into causes. He never assumes that things have inherent essence. It is always causes that is the point. And so then he asks, well, what is the cause for old age and death? And if someone were to ask you, or were to ask the kind of average person on the street, what is the cause of old age and death? What would they say? What is the cause for old age and death? They would say, well, cause for old age is because, you know, you're getting worn out and you've been working hard and your genetic makeup is kind of falling apart and whatever, whatever kind of internal other causes for these things. Well, what are the causes for death? Well, you know, you just get old or you have cancer or you get, you know, a car runs over you or whatever. This is kind of the causes for death. And this is kind of why this is interesting, because when the Buddha looks into the causes, of course, and you know the answer already, but he looks at this in a very different kind of way, in a way that is kind of baffling, in a way that no one would ever really think about the causes of death and old age. And this is the Buddha reflecting on dependent origination. Then, through proper attention, this is yoniso manasikara, proper attention, I comprehended with wisdom. When rebirth exists, or birth exists, there is old age and death. Rebirth is the condition for old age and death. This is how the Buddha thinks. Now, if you were to ask almost anyone in the world, and you tell them that birth is the cause for death or the cause for old age, if you say that to a random person, they wonder what you're talking about. It's kind of, because it sounds weird. I mean, of course, birth is the condition, but so what? It's kind of seems like irrelevant. That is not really interesting. But this is what makes the Buddha so special, that the investigation in a much deeper way into these kind of things. Of course, it helped a lot that society, they had an idea of rebirth, so it kind of made this whole thing more natural to think in that way. And that shows you that for the Buddha to arise in the world, it often takes a certain kind of society. It takes certain supporting conditions. Otherwise, it's very hard to become a Buddha if you live in, in a kind of modern society. It is probably not feasible to become a Buddha, perhaps. But in those days, because you had certain supporting conditions, the society had a respect for ascetics who left the life. There was already a practice going on of samadhi in that society. There were ideas about rebirth. There was already quite close to many of the ideas that are required for an understanding of the Dhamma. And that makes the distance that the Buddha had to cover to find the truth much less. And this, I think, is one of the reasons why this is possible. And from our point of view, it seems really astonishing. But in that society, probably not quite as astonishing. Anyway, rebirth is the cause for old age and death. And when you think about it, it makes very good sense. But then he goes on. Then it occurred to me. When what exists is their rebirth, continued existence. Bhava is the Pali word. Jati is rebirth. Bhava is continued existence. So you have to exist beforehand for rebirth to happen. There has to be a certain existence. And exactly what that means is a controversial, what that bhava refers to. But it refers possibly to the bhava, like the intermediate existence that you have before you get reborn. It can maybe even refer to the existence in the previous life where you live in a certain way. The commentaries, they make a distinction between what they call kama bhava and upapatti bhava. I think kama bhava is the kama that you create in a previous life. It is that all the how you live your life. Upapatti bhava is the re-arising existence. You re-arise in a new life. So it is continued existence. Some sort of existence is required before rebirth can happen. What is the cause for that? The grasping, the grasping here being the upadana, the picking up of things, the holding on to things in the world, all the things that we are, that we grasp in our lives, that are important to us, that we pick up, the things that we hold on to. And the grasping to things comes from craving. Craving comes from feeling. Feeling, Vedana. Vedana comes from passa, contact, or the experience of the world. We experience the world through the six sense fields, the Salayatana. And the Salayatana, the six sense fields, exist because of name and form, Nama Rupa. Nama Rupa is like the individual existence. And what is the condition for name and form? Then through proper attention I comprehended with wisdom. When consciousness exists, there is name and form. When there is vijnana, there is nama rupa. Consciousness is the condition for name and form. Then it occurred to me, when what exists is there consciousness? What is the condition for consciousness? Then through proper attention I comprehended with wisdom, when there is nama-rupa, name and form, there is consciousness. Nama-rupa is a condition or a condition for consciousness. So this is dependent origination. This is the 10 link or the 10 factor sequence of dependent origination. The usual one has 12, it has two more, but there are various variations on dependent origination that shows it from different angles and different kind of viewpoints, and this is an important one. Let's just carry on a little bit more. Now, maybe if you have time, I'll go into a little bit more detail about how this dependent origination works. Then it occurred to me, this consciousness turns back from name and form. It doesn't go beyond that. This is the extent to which one may be reborn, grow old, die, pass away, and reappear. That is, name and form are the conditions for consciousness. Consciousness is the condition for name and form. Name and form is the condition for the six sense fields. The six sense fields are the condition for contact, passa, or experience, etc., etc., all the way up to old age and death. That is how this entire mass of suffering originates. Origination. Such was the vision, the knowledge, the wisdom, the realization, the light that arose in me regarding the teachings not learnt before from another. This is dependent origination, and it's a bit baffling when you come across it the first time. But a lot of this is not that hard to understand, and the basic idea is actually fairly easy to see what is going on. So here, the Buddha starts off by talking about this mutual conditionality between consciousness, vijnana, on the one hand, and nama-rupa, name and form, on the other hand. There is no consciousness beyond name and form. There is no name and form beyond consciousness. These two always support each other. And this is like the most profound or insight of the Buddha. This is almost like what the Buddhist teaching is about and how it compares to existing teachings of the time. That consciousness doesn't have any self existence, no inherent existence on its own. It depends on other things for its own existence. And this is radical, and this is really radical because at that time, the way that the Brahmanical tradition viewed this, the idea was that Brahma is like the consciousness of the world. Yeah, it's like God, if you like, is their idea of God, the world consciousness, the consciousness that underlies all of existence. It is there, and our individual self is somehow part of that larger consciousness. And when you die, your Atman is that individual self. It kind of you goes back to Brahman, this individual consciousness or mind or whatever. And so in that whole viewpoint, there is really only one consciousness. It's the world consciousness. And everything else kind of is almost like an illusion, or it's only temporary. And then it goes, and then you kind of go back to that universal consciousness again. This is the Brahmanical idea. And the Buddha says it is wrong. The Buddha says it doesn't work like that. This is not how the universe works. Consciousness does not exist on its own. It doesn't have any, it doesn't stand by itself. It depends on other factors for its existence. And what it depends on specifically, according to this, is nama rupa, name and form. So how should we understand name and form? And there's two kind of ways of understanding this, that I'm aware of. And one is that name and form is the aspects of your personality. They are the aspects of your mind. They are the physical body. And so consciousness depends on all of these other aspects for its existence. It can never stand alone. It only works together with the other factors of what it is to be a human being, you know, to be any kind of being. The other thing which it means is that according to the Brahmanical tradition, the underlying reality is just one mass of consciousness, one undivided consciousness that every being is kind of part of and everyone belongs to. And it's a very attractive idea because it takes away all the conflict and violence in the world, all the separation. It gives this idea of universality to existence. But attractiveness is one thing, but the question is it real? It doesn't matter if it's an attractive idea. The question is it really real? And the Buddha says, no, consciousness depends on name and form. Name and form are individuality. You have a name, you have a form. This is what makes everyone who they are. This is how we distinguish them from other beings, because they have that individuality, which is often known through name and form. That's how we differentiate people. And so consciousness depends on that individuality. Consciousness is never universal. It always relates to individuals. And so this is then a very profound criticism, if you like, of the Brahmanical religion, that this underlying idea of consciousness actually is a false view of existence. It always relates to individuals. And that changes things dramatically. So if you want to end the problem of the world, you have to, if you want to end your individuality or whatever, you have to actually end consciousness. So if individuality is a problem, and this is kind of what the Buddha says, consciousness itself must come to an end. And this is what this is about. The consciousness here means just awareness. It means the ability to know anything at all. Depends on individuality, depends on the personality, depend on who you are as a person. Now, once you are a being, right, and then kind of this whole dependent origination emerges from that. Once you have an individual being, that being senses the world, and this is the six sense fields. This is how we kind of touch the world, if you like. Then they become a condition for the six sense fields. Once you have the six sense fields, the six senses, that is how you experience the world through those six senses. Passa, the experience of the world through the six senses. One of the most important aspects of that contacting or experience of the world is Vedana. Vedana is the next factor here, because Vedana is the feeling. Does the world feel good? Does it feel bad? Or is it neutral? And again, as I said before, this is the most important underlying aspect of the personality, or the most important aspect of the personality, because this is what drives us. This is what motivates us in the world. We all want more of the good feelings, less of the bad feelings, and maybe if we have insight, we want the neutral feelings. But this is what makes us, motivates us in everything we do. And if you start to look at your life and what drives you to come here on this retreat, to go back again when you finish, to do all the things in your daily life, everything is driven by this feeling. Vedana is what drives everything. That is what gives life meaning. The purpose is to find more satisfaction, more happiness, less suffering. This is why we choose almost anything in life. And because this is the motivating factor, then of course Vedana leads to craving, because craving is the movement in the world. That is the agitation, that is the restlessness, that is what makes the will start to do things, because craving comes from that, is motivated by the feelings in the world. And then when we crave things, because we crave things, we take things up. We take things up like we take up meditation practice, we take up living in a house, we take up having a job, we take up an education, we take up a spiritual path, we take up views and ideas about the world. All of these things are things we pick up, and then because we pick them up, we hold on to them, we grasp them, they become important to us, because these are the things that we do to satisfy that craving, underlying craving. And that grasping onto things in the world becomes the fuel. For the fuel for rebirth is often called the fuel. It drives us on because we're holding on to the world. Craving and grasping together attaches us to to the wheel of existence, and then we continue existing as through that fuel, and this continued existence then drives us on. So that's how we get driven on, and then rebirth happens as a consequence. And then when you get reborn, of course, old age, suffering, and all of these things comes from that rebirth. So that is basically how dependent origination works. There is one way of thinking about it. It goes back even further as well. So kind of behind the idea of consciousness and name and form is the idea of sankhara. Sankhara is the will again. And that will is kind of blind in Buddhism. And it's blind because it is conditioned by avidya. Avidya is the ignorance or the delusion about the world. We don't know what we're doing. So the blind will fumbles around in the world trying to create happiness, not really understanding what is going on. And as we fumble around, we hurt ourselves. This is the dukkha of life, and we don't really know what we are doing here. So something like that is how this dependent origination works. And because avidya, ignorance or delusion, is at the root problem of dependent origination, you can then understand why the Noble Eightfold Path is about insight. It's about seeing things clearly, because it ends that ignorance and delusion at the beginning of dependent origination. So we gain insight, so we abandon that avidya, that ignorance, and then the whole thing unravels, because the root cause of dependent origination is gone. The whole thing unravels, and you make an end of dukkha, of suffering, as a consequence. That is a brief dependent origination in brief. And we have done retreats here before on just dependent origination, the whole retreat, so we can talk about this at great length. But you don't really need to talk about it in such great length, as long as you have a little bit of understanding can be helpful. So then the Buddha's inquiry goes further. He has now understood why there is old age and death. And then it occurred to me, when what does not exist, is there no old age and death? When what ceases, do old age and death cease? Then through proper attention, yoniso manasikara, I comprehend it with wisdom. When rebirth does not exist, there is no old age and death. When rebirth ceases, old age and death cease. Then it occurred to me, when what does not exist, is there no rebirth? When there is no continued existence. And then when there is no grasping, no craving, no feeling, no contact or experience, no six sense fields, no name and form. When what ceases, do name and form cease? Then through proper attention, I comprehend it with wisdom. When consciousness doesn't exist, there is no name and form. When consciousness ceases, name and form cease. Then it occurred to me, when what doesn't exist, is there no consciousness? When what ceases, does consciousness cease? Then through proper attention, I comprehend it with wisdom. When name and form don't exist, there is no consciousness. When name and form cease, consciousness ceases. Then it occurred to me, I have discovered the path to awakening. That is, when name and form cease, consciousness ceases. When consciousness ceases, name and form cease. When name and form cease, the sixth sense field cease, etc., etc. That is how this entire mass of suffering ceases. Cessation, cessation. Such was the vision, the knowledge, the wisdom, the realization, the light that arose in me regarding teachings not learned before from another. So this is the Buddha's insight into dependent origination and understanding how this whole problem arises. And then, of course, the solution comes with that. And that solution is the abandoning of ignorance. And now comes this simile, and this simile is really the reason why I chose this sutta. I didn't really want to bring in too much dependent origination, but nevertheless, there you are. So this is the simile. Suppose a person was walking through a forest. They would see an ancient path, an ancient route traveled by humans in the past. following it along, they would see an ancient city here, an ancient capital inhabited by human beings in the past. It was lovely, complete with parks, groves, lotus ponds, and embankments. Then the person would inform a king or the minister, "Please, sir, you should know this. While walking through a forest, I saw an ancient path, an ancient route traveled by humans in the past. Following it along, I saw an ancient city, an ancient capital inhabited by humans in the past. It was lovely, complete with parks, groves, lotus ponds, and embankments. Sir, you should rebuild that city." Then that king or the minister would have that city rebuilt. And after some time, the city was successful and prosperous and full of people, attained to growth and expansion. In the same way, I saw an ancient path, an ancient route traveled by the fully awakened Buddhas in the past. And what is that ancient path? The ancient road traveled by the fully awakened Buddhas in the past? It is simply this Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. This is that ancient path, the ancient road traveled by the fully awakened Buddhas in the past. And so this is this simile of like discovery, the simile of going through the jungle and finding something amazing and remarkable. And it's like everyone, we kind of enjoy discovery in this world, doing things that are exciting and finding something new. And sometimes, when I was a child, I used to live close to the forest, and I would, go into the forest and look for little caves and little hollows and searching things out. And this kind of idea of discovery, I think, is very close to the human heart. The idea of kind of investigating the world, trying to find out what is going on, understanding things. And here we have this kind of highest kind of discovery, the real discovery here, at the very essence of what it means to be a human being. This beautiful simile of searching, looking for things, and trying to find something really profound. And so here, this ancient path, traveled by the Buddhas in the past, is the Noble Eightfold Path, the Buddha says here. And that already is very interesting, because very, as I mentioned before, I talked about the idea of the idea of what it is to be a bodhisattva, and the kind of the developed Buddhist idea of the bodhisattva is that the bodhisattva travels the bodhisattva path. He doesn't travel the kind of the ordinary path, and he goes on for eons perfecting the paramis or whatever. But no, in this very sutta, it says the Buddha travels the Noble Eightfold Path. It's exactly the same path as everyone else. There is no difference. This is the path that the Buddha uses to reach awakening. And here you have it, right there in this early Buddhist texts, the things that are most likely to be the word of the Buddha. And so that is already very interesting. And so he goes and he discovers this path in the jungle, and it's kind of really exciting. You discover something new. And not only do you discover something new, but this thing that you discover is just really interesting. This ancient civilization, this ancient city somewhere in the jungle. And this may very well have been the case in ancient India, because there was a lot of old things already in existence in India at that time. We know that there were civilizations in India going back thousands of years before the Buddha. You have the Indus Valley civilization, which is very famous, which kind of stretches back 5,000 to 5,000 years ago or something. And some of the most ancient excavations there, I understand, are almost 10,000 years old. They're really, really ancient. And so you would have had this opportunity of discovery in ancient India, this excitement of doing something really extraordinary. But it's not just that you find something exceptional. This ancient city, as you go along, an ancient capital, something really worthwhile discovering. And it has all of these beautiful aspects to it. It is not just any old capital, it is lovely, complete with parks, groves, lotus ponds, and embankments. And this, of course, is exactly the discovery that we are on. The discovery of discovering some extraordinary things. as you deepen your meditation, as you walk on this path, you start to understand how extraordinary this path actually is, how interesting it is, how meaningful it is. I always like to say that the Buddhist path and the Buddhist practice is about the meaning of life. And you actually do discover the meaning of life through this practice. And this is what makes it so extraordinary. If you discover the meaning of life, what else are you going to do? This is what you need to do. Yeah. And all of these things come out of this process of discovery in this ancient jungle, seeing all of these beautiful and amazing things on this path. And then once you have made that discovery, of course, then the Buddha, he goes and informs the other people, the other kings and the ministers, please know what I have found. I found this extraordinary thing here. And then as the word gets around, more and more people have the same kind of insight and understanding. And that city becomes populous, yeah, and successful, full of people attained to growth and expansion. And this is like the Dhamma kind of finding a foothold in the world, spreading out, yeah, from one generation to the next one, from one society to the next one, one culture to the next one. And as it goes out, it becomes attained to growth and expansion. But of course, it's not just about Buddhism as a culture, but it's about Buddhism as a deep insight into the nature of reality. That is the critical thing here. And then the Buddha says, well, following along that path, the Noble Eightfold Path, I directly knew old age and death, their origin, the cessation, and the practice that leads to the cessation. Following it along, I directly knew rebirth, continued existence, grasping, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense fields, name and form, consciousness. Following it along, I directly knew choices. Choices here is sankhara, their origin, the cessation, and the practice that leads to the cessation. So here the Buddha brings in one more factor that we didn't see before. This is sankhara. And of course, when you bring in sankhara, which are choices, you're also kind of bringing in, sneaking in avidya as well. Because sankharas are driven by avidya, by ignorance, by delusion. So now we get the 12 factors sort of dependent origination. Having directly known this, I told the monks, the nuns, the laymen, the laywomen. And that is how the spiritual life has become successful and prosperous. Extensive, popular, widespread, and well proclaimed wherever there are gods and humans. And that is why we are here now, because of the spreading out of these teachings of the Buddha. And we still have these teachings. It's kind of amazing, after 2,500 years, they are still there. And we can know with a fair amount of certainty that these teachings are indeed the word of the Buddha, the word of the spiritual master who existed 2,500 years ago. And we have inherited these teachings from the Buddha, still available. The path is still open. The practice still goes on, for who knows how long. And it's really up to us to ensure that the spiritual path is left open for future generations. And of course, the way to do that is to practice. The way to do that is to live these Buddhist teachings to the best of our ability. And as we do so, that is how we ensure the future of Buddhism, the future of Dhamma in the world. We don't ensure the future of the Dhamma, as sometimes is done, by fighting with others because they are destroying Buddhism. Actually, that is the way that we too destroy Buddhism, because we're no longer living according to the Buddha's example. Instead, we're trying to suppress other people because we think that they are destroying it by taking over our country or whatever. No, Buddhism is kept up by the practice, not by kind of political means and wars and aggression and these kind of things. If you want the Dhamma to live in the world, we have to practice the Dhamma. That is how it carries on for the future. So there you are. And this kind of gives you an idea, this little retreat, on how to do that, what it is that you have to do. And you will notice how simple it really is. I'm always surprised that there are so many ways in which we can complicate these teachings, and I've just complicated it for you quite a bit by bringing independent origination at the very end, so I apologize for that, because that was a bit naughty of me. But please don't allow yourself to be distracted too much about these complications. Come back to the simple ideas, and the simple ideas are really just again, this idea of virtue or kindness at the beginning of the path. And there's only one thing that you need to remember in your life all the time, and that is the idea of kindness, which includes generosity, which includes how we treat other people, which includes ethics and morality, what we should not be doing. And if you live a life of kindness internally, without really caring what other people think about you, without trying to show off your kindness, but just being an internal compass in your life, then everything else comes out of that. The meditation happens because you are living really well. And then the second aspect of the path is that meditation. It is the mindfulness of breathing that takes you all the way to the end of the path. So these two things that you need to do. Live well, live with kindness, and then practice the meditation based on that kindness. So how can we do that? People often think that, well, at least, you know, remembering kindness is easy because only one thing to remember in your life. But actually it is hard to remember kindness. Very often we forget it. Very often we get distracted by other things. Very often we think that the things in life are important and we need to get this done. And then we forget actually what really is important, and that is the qualities you put into your acts rather than the actions themselves. And to remember this, one of the most important things is to come back to these teachings again and again and again. Listen to these teachings, read the word of the Buddha, go on retreats occasionally to kind of get the full breadth of understanding what the suttas are about. Come back to the simple teachings, just to listen to someone, to be inspired, to be lifted up, to allow yourself to carry on in the path. It's this kind of brainwashing. That's really what it is, right? But brainwashing is okay, because brainwashing is not really something that you can choose whether you want to be brainwashed or not. You are going to be brainwashed. You just have to choose the good kind of brainwashing. That's really what it comes down to. And so come back to the good brainwashing, and then gradually over time everything gets built up. You remember what really matters in life, you do the right thing, and then the path progresses. So this is really what it is all about. So I wish you all the very best of luck with your practice. May you all have lots of success, lots of happiness, and lots of meaning coming out of these teachings. And then hopefully, we'll see you back here again at Jhana Grove down the track. I know some of you are going to come back because you always come back, which is great, until you don't come back anymore, which is when you don't come back. But in the meantime, you will come back. And that's kind of how things are here. So that is all for now. Shall we say sadhu, Ananda? Is that a good time to say sadhu three times? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And before we leave, I would also like to take the opportunity to thank everyone for your support. There's been lots of beautiful thank you notes already, but it is also something that I would like to do as well, and to thank the organizers. Sometimes it's very hard to know how much organization lies behind this. There's a lot of really hard work. And of course, those people who do that, they're making good karma, they're doing it out of the goodness of the heart, but nevertheless, it's wonderful to have a sense of gratitude for these people. And people like the caretakers here, Scotty and Christina, like Lehar, who pretty much runs this thing, Burr, who is also part of that team, the people in the kitchen, Norlia, and everyone else, and the many other people helping out in little ways as well. And what a wonderful thing that is, that we can kind of build this thing up together in this way. And of course, there is, as someone mentioned the other day, Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm is the vision behind much of this. And without him, this would never have happened. So very important to take account of Ajahn Brahm as well. And then thanking all of you for coming, yeah, and for kind of, I can thank myself as well for being here. So it all kind of comes together in this way when we work together in this way. So let's continue to work together in harmony and peace in this way. Yeah. And then we are, everyone is going to prosper as a consequence. So there you are. Yeah. So maybe we should end by again paying respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha one last time. And actually, one of the people we should thank as well are the people who bring the food. Yeah, so many people bring the food every day, and it's kind of extraordinary when you think about it, bringing food for 60 people on a retreat like this, usually paying for everything themselves, doing all the cooking. And some of the people, they came twice during this retreat. Yeah. And it's kind of extraordinary to think of that. It's another kind of good basis for having gratitude for what is going on. Okay, let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.